or less outcompeted, or at least there's been an attempt to outcompete them, and they're feeling very beaten. So when you read Petrarch here, he is at the beginning of that revival, and of course they're going to call this the Renaissance, and that's Petrarch's term, trying to dismiss what had come before with the medieval. But out of this humanism then, that we will call now Renaissance humanism, out of this humanism, we have three forms. We have the form that Petrarch takes, the form that Pico takes, and Machiavelli. So there's a lot more than this, obviously. And if you end up taking, you know, one of Dr. Gaetano's classes on the Renaissance, you're obviously going to hear and learn a lot more about this in the kind of detail that we're going into right now. But for our class, this is what I want you to know. And one of the things that comes up out of this, especially with Petrarch and Pico, so more on kind of a, what I would consider the good side of humanism as opposed to the diabolical side, is an idea that I want you all to know, and Pico won't make sense at all unless you at least, I'm sorry, it looks like you've got a huge malt liquor can. I wasn't going to judge, but I thought, you know, that's extreme for 10 in the morning. Okay, so as this happens, there are really two ways to kind of think about the creation of the universe. So remember, with the medieval, there's the idea of unity. Everything moves towards the godhood in some way. It doesn't mean we become God, but God holds all things together through his love that never stops one member of the Trinity to the other member in that constant circle of perfect love. So everything is unified. The way a medieval would have described then creation itself, and this may sound old-fashioned, but Washington uses it. So even though it's a very medieval notion, we'll see it even in Washington's addresses, what was known as the economy of grace. An economy here is exactly what its Greek would suggest. It just means community. So economy is the word we use, obviously, economics, to try and explain why we barter and trade. But economy, or its origin in Greek, is just simply community. It's what communities do. It's how we interact with one another. So the economy of grace was the medieval understanding that God's grace is thrown out into the universe, and it's always there. So in this room, it's truly just bouncing around this room. It's everywhere. It's in each one of us. It's in the ability I have to speak and the ability you have to hear, to breathe, all of these things. Grace permeates everything. So if you remember, we talked about this much earlier, but the early church always talks about sola gratia, faith alone, or excuse me, not faith alone, grace alone, grace everywhere. So sola gratia, everything comes from grace. That's the economy of grace. But in the Renaissance, this becomes a little bit more complicated and a little bit more, I'm not sure I'd say scientific, but certainly it's parsed into different ways. So the economy of grace becomes what's called the great chain of being. And they're definitely related. So, and there's nothing wrong with either, though they could be taken in different ways. So the economy of grace suggests that there's God's love that's just free-flowing. It's what animates everything. Remember the end of Dante, the love that moves the stars itself. But for the great chain of being, it's more of a hierarchical idea. So the economy of grace suggests grace is everywhere. We're all included in it. That's not included in the great chain of being, but the great chain of being posits that you can actually have almost a ladder. So that at the top of that ladder, you have God, the absolute. At the bottom of that ladder, you might have a rock, anything in the created order. And so in this chain of being, I guess I could map this out, I'm not sure how useful this will be, but in the great chain of being, I'm not sure where to put it, it's right here. You would have God at the top, maybe a rock, I don't know what, at the bottom. And then in between, you would have, say, vegetation and animals and man and angels. Yeah, that works. Okay. So the idea is that the farther you go from God, it's implied there's less grace. So the rock obviously doesn't move unless it's given force. But it implies there's less grace. But notice, as opposed to this, the unity, which is kind of all-encompassing and a little bit fuzzy and nice and kind of hippie-ish, this is much more regimented, this economy of grace. So that it's almost direct that we can say, look, as you descend, you're becoming less and less. And it's not a sharing as much as it is almost a distribution of that grace. So what's argued in the Renaissance in this great chain of being, so this can be a perfectly fine way of thinking theologically. There's nothing wrong with it. But what happens in the Renaissance is you get people like Pico who say, well, how come we always talk about becoming less? Why is it that as we move away from God, we become less? Why wouldn't the Godhead want us to become more? So why aren't we moving up the ladder? Is it possible to get on the ladder as a human and to become an angel or to become a god? We know that we can devolve. We all know that, right? We'd be a couch potato, be a total vegetable. We can sit on the couch, we can watch TV or play video games all day. Actually, playing video games is a much higher thing than watching TV. But you know, you can do these different things. But in other words, you just become kind of vegetative. You become like a vegetable. So he says, we take that for granted because of sin, that we can go down. Well, through grace, why can't we go up? And that becomes the argument. As I labeled it, it was the idyllic, A-I-D-Y-L-L-I-C. That becomes the notion of Pico. And that's where Renaissance humanism starts getting a really bad name. That, well, come on, you know, we're positing man as God, or as potentially God. And Pico's response is, and I don't agree with him, obviously, and I don't think you could be a good Christian, or even a bad Christian, and agree with him. But his argument is, well, no, if I can become a vegetable, I can also become a God. So it has to go both ways. So Pico is going to give us a slight variation on this. But it's Petrarch that I had you read first, and there's a reason we put him first in the book. He's not only the earliest, but he's also by far the definitive Christian humanist in history. So the one who can pull together Socrates and Jesus about as perfectly as anyone has ever been able to do. So in the 20th century, it'll be a huge movement. Right? We see it in C.S. Lewis, we see it in Tolkien, we see it in T.S. Eliot, we see it in a lot of figures. But at the early medieval, or the late medieval, early Renaissance, this is a pretty major kind of reassertion of these Christian humanist ideals that obviously have been around since Paul, but they kind of come and go in popularity. And Petrarch is suggesting that if we're going to understand the loss of the medieval, this is the best way to do it. But of course, he's also the one perpetuating the loss of the medieval. So he's an enigma, to be sure. So let's go ahead and, if you don't mind, we'll look at him. And then on Friday, I want you guys to read, as I mentioned, Machiavelli. I will not be here because I'm going to be at a conference, but my wife will be leading discussion on that. And then on Monday, and I don't know how many of you are going to be here on Monday. I'm assuming most of you will be here. But on Monday when we have class, Thanksgiving week, I'm gonna start the Reformation just a little bit, but I'm also going to read to you from a play that I think will help shape your ideas about Machiavelli. Machiavelli, and my wife will talk a little bit about this, but Machiavelli is always one of these figures that we're never quite sure what to do with, because he does seem to introduce a kind of diabolic humanism, but he writes two major books during his life, one, The Prince, which just seems to be a handbook for evil, and then the other one he writes is The Discourses, which is kind of a straightforward, good old Christian humanist, Republican look at government and society. And scholars have always tried to figure out, well, is it which Machiavelli is the real Machiavelli? And I have very strong feelings about this. I tend to be very anti-Machiavelli, and you don't have to agree with me on that, but I tend to think that he is truly diabolic, and that his discourses is just kind of it's a game for him. But the reason I'll do that, I'm going to read to you from a very disturbing play that he wrote. It's often, The Tempest is usually regarded as Shakespeare's answer to Machiavelli. So if you've read The Tempest, you'll at least be somewhat familiar. And also Measure for Measure as well. Both are kind of answers by Shakespeare. But this this play that I'm going to read from, which is funny in an extremely dark way, is called Mandragula. Anybody in here ever read it? It's actually a short. You could read it pretty easily if you're interested in it. But Mandragula, mandrake root, the devil, right, the dragon, so the root or poison of the dragon. And the story revolves around a nun who supposedly gets pregnant by an upper class man, and for everybody to save face, there's money that's exchanged so that money goes to the church, so that the church will get something to this young woman, the man Dragula Root, that she'll drink and have an abortion in the nunnery. And the whole thing is basically, if everybody benefits, except for the baby, if everybody benefits, is it worth doing? And the play's answer is yes. If everybody looks better, the ruler, the church, the nun, everybody, it's worth having an abortion. And that's Machiavelli. So we've got to be really careful when we're reading him, because I think he is trying to do very duplicitous things. And I do have strong views, but we'll come back to that. I also, I'll just quote, and Deidre will bring this up on Friday as well, but Russell Kirk in his own work on Western civilization has this great statement where he says, yet with Machiavelli, so ends the West. So from Socrates to Dante, you have this very humane understanding of Western civilization, and Machiavelli destroys all of that. He brings the end about. That's too strong, but at the same time, it's a viable argument, at least symbolically. Okay, so let's jump back to Petrarch, and we're on page 515. So we'll get here the kind of, he's going to seem thin-skinned, so turn to 516. He's going to seem pretty thin-skinned as he's trying to explain who he is. He's also, and I would only know this because I've taught this now 18 years, he's also extremely funny. But you won't, if you don't catch that, don't worry. I certainly did not catch it the first few years I was teaching this. It was only after teaching I realized this is drop-dead funny. But you also have to be kind of a nerdy academic who's studied this for years for it to be funny. So anyway, just to let you know, if I'm up here laughing, you'll know why. I'm not laughing at your reading. I'm laughing because I'm finding certain things extremely funny. Okay, so anybody, Scott? You read fairly recently, haven't you?
I can read it.
Do you mind anyway? Let's go ahead. Why don't you start? What is it that they envy me? They're on 516.
Okay. What is it that they envy me? I do not know, I must admit, and I am amazed when I try to find out. Certainly it is not wealth, for every single one of them surpasses me as much in wealth as the British whale is bigger than the dolphin, as that man has said. Moreover, they wish me even greater wealth. They know that what I have is moderate, not my own property, but to be shared with others. It is not magnificent, but very modest, without haughtiness and pomp. They know that it really does not deserve any envy. They will not envy me, my friends. The greater part of them death has taken from me, and I have the habit of sharing them willingly, just like everything else, with other friends. They cannot envy me the shapeliness of my body. If there was ever such a thing, it has vanished entirely in the course of the years that vanquish all. By God's overflowing and preserving grace, it is still quite satisfactory for my present age, but it has certainly long since ceased to be enviable. And if it were still as it once was, could I forget, or could I then have forgotten the poetic sentence I drank in as a small boy, shapeliness is a frail possession, or the words of Solomon in the book in which he teaches the young, gracefulness is deceit and beauty is vain. How should they then envy me what I do not have, what I held in contempt while I had it, and what I would despise now to the utmost were it given back to me, having learned and experienced how unstable it is. They cannot even envy me learning and eloquence. Learning, they declare, I have absolutely none. Eloquence, if I had any, they despise according to the modern philosophic fashion. They reject it as unworthy of a man of letters. Thus, only infantile inability to speak and perplexed stammering wisdom, trying hard to keep one eye open and yawning drowsily, as Cicero called it, is held in good repute nowadays. They do not call to mind Plato, the most eloquent of all men, and, let me omit the others, Aristotle, sweet and mild, but whom they made trite. From Aristotle's ways they swerve, taking eloquence to be an obstacle and a disgrace to philosophy, while he considered it a mighty adornment and tried to combine it with philosophy, prevailed upon, it is asserted, by the fame of the orator Isocrates. Not even virtue can they envy me, though it is beyond doubt the best and most enviable of all things. To them it seems worthless, I believe, because it is not inflated and puffed up with arrogance.
Okay, let's stop there. Thanks, Scott. So I don't know if you're catching this. He's completely mocking his body, right, in doing this. And he's arguing, even if I could be 20 again, I probably still would be a fool if I had that kind of body at 20. So he understands that youth is fleeting, but he's willing to take certain things with it. So, John, go ahead.
So he says, they don't envy my shapeliness because I have none, and it's a bad thing, but I mean, that's kind of setting him up setting them up to envy his lack of shapeliness. I mean, I'm not saying that's the case, but then they don't envy my learning, eloquence, or virtue. In fact, they discredit those things, but it could be they discredit them because they envy him. A lot of the time, that's how envy works, you know, sour grapes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So let's think about this. This is great, John. So let's think about what he's saying here. And we can basically put this in a modern context. So just imagine, and I know because I know you guys well enough, and I know what Hillsdale students are like, but tell me, any one of you, if there hasn't been a time in your life where you've been dismissed as unintelligent because you're really nice. It's what he's saying. It's like, okay, so I'm a nice guy, so they must think I don't have real high intelligence. And by the way, I can speak well. So what is that? I'm like a used car salesman. I'm not really saying anything, but I can present myself well. So he's followed all the classical understanding. He tries his best to live by virtue. He tries to be a good, decent, charitable person to everybody. And he still believes in the old rules of rhetoric, that it is decorum. You know, I should dress well. I should speak well. I should present myself. And people kind of mock him. It's like, oh, he just cares about the things of this world. Well, it's just the opposite, actually. Petrarch is one of these guys who's done everything right, and so people mock him as a fool because he's tried to do everything right. And he's almost seen as kind of a, and I know I'm going to date myself with this, probably, actually, it's more my mom's term than it would be mine, but he's more of a, he's like a goody two-shoes. He's a Pollyanna. Everything is just kind of, he does what's right, and he doesn't follow the rules necessarily by this world. He follows the rules of God, and he's seen as a fool. But it has a lot to do with this fact. And this, John, I'm so glad you asked this, because a lot of what he's trying to suggest is, just because I treat you with dignity doesn't mean I don't think you're an idiot. It just means, and I'm not saying this is him, right? It don't take it that way, or don't think that I've shut my brain off as you're insulting me. I've just decided I'm not gonna lower myself to that level. So you can insult me and think that I missed it because I'm dumb. But in fact, I caught it all. I'm just above thinking that I need to go down to your level to do that. Does that make sense for everyone? So that's what, there's a lot of the 13-year-old smart kid nerd in Petrarch who's still kind of ticked off that he wasn't the more popular kid, but he also recognizes this was the right thing to do. So that's what he's trying to get at. And notice what he says here. Very importantly, I still consider virtue the most important thing, but you seem to think it's worthless because it's not inflated and it's puffed up, or not puffed up with arrogance. So just imagine, and I'm not trying to knock anyone in particular at all. This happens in all politics everywhere. But just imagine what happened in the election where we had really, really nice people next to really aggressive people. What happened to the nice people? They're gone. Right? And that, so we may all pretend, I mean, America may say, we really want to be a kind nation. But in fact, we elect jerks. We just do. And we like the fact that they are jerkish. We like the fact that they can be manipulative. And we don't necessarily respect the fact that we want them to be good people. In fact, that seems foolish. Is that really the kind of person we want dealing with Russia? Someone who's, you know, been married his whole life, hasn't divorced, who's been part of this. These are interesting things that are going on. And so this is not new. Obviously, Petrarch's writing this around 1370. Right? These are old arguments. But this is the nature of the world and what he's trying to fight against. So if you think about in the past, who does he somewhat sound like? And I think this goes back to John's question as well. There's a Socratic element, but who else does he sound like from what we've talked about, except he's more of a good guy? Among all the ancients we talked about.
Cicero?
Yeah, there is a bit of Cicero, but he's not as high, right? Remember, Cicero's an aristocrat. Petrarch's clearly not that. So Cicero, he definitely sounds like Cicero. There's no doubt about that. And he's read his Cicero, and he loves Cicero. He is a Ciceronian, so you're absolutely right about that, Scott. But in terms of personality, who does he sound like?
Cato?
Yeah, there's a bit of Cato, but again, he's not that upper crust. But Diogenes is who I'm thinking of, right? Remember the cynic. Though, in a sense, he's not cynic because he has great faith in the next world. But his idea is, well, look, I'm just going to walk around and do my thing. And I may rub your face in it at times, but you probably won't get that I'm doing that. And you'll probably think you're besting me because you think I'm stupid, right? So that's part. So he's kind of killing with kindness in the way that he's going around, whereas Diogenes was killing with bitterness and cynicism. But I think these comparisons are great. Okay, so let's jump forward just a little bit more. And now he's going to get pretty nasty here, because he's going to start arguing. Let's go to 5:18, and that first full paragraph. So, Nate, would you mind reading here?
5:19?
Yeah, but I will go alone, or I will go on. 5:18. Yeah.
But I will go on. They think that they are great men, and they are certainly rich, all of them, which is the only mortal greatness nowadays. They feel, although many people deceive themselves in this respect, that they have not won a name and cannot hope to ever win one if their foreboding is right. Among such sorrows, they languish anxiously, and so great is the power of evil that they stick out their tongues and sharpen their teeth like mad dogs, even against friends, and wound those whom they love. Is this not a strange kind of blindness, a strange kind of fury? In just this manner, the frantic mother of Pentheus tears her son to pieces, and the raving Hercules his infant children. They love me and all that is mine, with the single exception of my name, which I do not refuse to change. Let me call them Thersites or Corylus, or whatever name they prefer, provided I thus obtain that this honest love suffers not the slightest restriction. They are all the more ablaze and aglow with a blind fire, since they are all such fervent scholars, working indefatigably all night long. However, the first of them has no learning at all. I tell you only what you know. The second knows a little, the third not much, the fourth, I must admit, not a little, but in such confused and undisciplined order, and, as Cicero says, with so much frivolity and vain boasting that it would perhaps be better to know nothing. For letters are instruments of insanity for many, of arrogance for almost everyone, if they do not meet with a good and well-trained mind.
Okay, thanks, Nate. Good job. So here we see him taking the discourse to a much more cynical level, but he's proclaiming, how do we know things? Well, it's not enough to know the facts. He's met these people. The second knows a little, the third not much, and the fourth, well, okay. So they may be really well trained. They may be excellent at whatever they're doing, but they don't have the larger picture. So they may be able to perform perfect heart surgery on you, but they may not have a clue what love is about. So that's what he's getting at here, that it's okay, there's nothing wrong with being an expert at something, but you also need to know these higher things. So you could have the best surgeon in the world, but he's only a quarter educated if he really doesn't know what love is. So that's what matters most, this ability to understand the human person. So same thing with a pilot. And of course, we don't ask it when we get onto a plane, we don't ask the pilot, hey, how are you doing with Aristotle's Politics? I need to know what you think about it before we fly. And none of us cares about that. But at the same time, it would be good if the pilot not only could fly a plane well, but also knew his Cicero or his Socrates. That would be great, or his Aristotle. So those are the kinds of things that Petrarch is saying. We need to be able to have a full education, not just a trained one. So if we jump forward again to page 521, now he's going to start criticizing, in particular, the scholastics for having gone too far here. So Lori, would you mind reading? Here, we'll just start on 521, therefore let learning. And I'm going to have you read onto the next page. So two full paragraphs.
Therefore, let learning be the portion of those who take it away from me, or since it cannot be their portion, unless I am mistaken, let it be the portion of those who may have it. Let them keep their exorbitant opinion of everything that regards them, and the naked name Aristotle, which delights many ignorant people, by its four syllables. Moreover, let them have the vain joy and the unfounded elation, which is so near to ruin. In short, let them have all the profit people who are ignorant and puffed up earn from their errors in vague and ease credulity. My portion shall be humility and ignorance, knowledge of my own weakness, and contempt for nothing except the world and myself, and the insolence of those who are condemning me, and furthermore, distrust in myself and hope in you. Finally, may God be my portion, and what they do not envy me, let it hurt you. They will burst into loud laughter when they hear this, and will say that I speak piously without learning like any old women. People people of their kind timid as they are with the fervor of literary erudition, know nothing so vile as piety. Truly and soberly, literate men love it above all things. For them it is written, piety is wisdom. However, my talking will confirm the others more and more in their opinion that I am a good man without learning. What shall we say now, my most faithful Donato? I speak to you since the sting of their grudge has wounded you more than myself, whom it actually stung. What shall we do, my friend? Shall we appeal to fair judges, or shall we keep silent and confirm their decision by your silence? I prefer the latter course. I want you to know that I do not in the least refuse to await the 10th day. This very moment, I acquiesce the verdict of any judge whomsoever. I implore you and everyone whom it may concern, all you who have passed a quite different sentence on to me, to hold your hand up as I do and let the verdict become right by patiently accepting it. I wish it were right on the point they conceived me. Willingly, I confess and freely declare their verdict is right in what they deprive me of, though I emphatically deny that there are the right judges. Perhaps they will seek support in the law of which their god Aristotle speaks when he says, everybody judges well of what he knows and is a good judge in that matter. It would not seem likely that anything can be better known than that in which that judges abounds. Under such a pretext, the most ignorant men would be best able to judge of ignorance, but it is not so.
Okay, good. Thank you very much, Lori. So once again, we have this argument about piety. Don't think that because someone is religious or pious that they're ignorant. It may be exactly the opposite that Petrarch is telling us. And the problem for his day and age is that all these people walk around and they may claim they're Christian, but really all they say is Aristotle. And they love Aristotle to the point where they've made an idol of him. And as he says, it's almost a sexual feeling for them to be able to say the four syllables, Aristotle. And they just, suddenly they're smart because they're able to quote Aristotle. And he's basically saying, you know, that's not a problem. Aristotle's fine, but you don't make him your god. And if that's all you know, you really are just as bad as the people who may be great engineers but know nothing about the heart. You may be just like them. So you've got to have this balance. And as he says, what's my portion? The only portion I really need is God's grace. And here we're back to the economy of grace. This is the only thing I really need. If God respects me because I've used the gifts he's given me, so be it. That's all I need. And he says, you probably think I'm an old woman, but okay, then I'm an old woman. That's what I am, as long as I'm doing what needs to be done. So if you jump forward again, this is, I think, probably, and I'll read through this, but I think this is the really critical part of Petrarch as he's trying to remind us of what a true humanity is rooted in Christianity is. So go to the bottom of 524, and here, and you can hear, I hope, those of you who've ever read Chesterton, you're going to hear Chesterton all over this, and there's no doubt that Chesterton was quite taken with Petrarch, and Chesterton saw himself. You think about even the way Chesterton looked, if you've ever seen pictures of him, he's very much a Petrarchian figure in the 20th century, and fighting, he's not fighting against the Aristotelians, he's fighting against the progressives, but it's the same thing, right? They too are titillated by the word progress, and so he's trying to fight, and that's exactly what Petrarch is doing here. So jump down, this is right around line 30. Right after, so I'm on page 524, line 30. In fact, I'll go 29. Thus we clearly ceased to be philosophers and eager lovers of wisdom and became Aristotelians. Okay, well that's a problem. Because now we focused on Aristotle, we've forgotten Plato and Socrates and Heraclitus and Thales and Aristotle's got all our answers, that's all we need. Well, that's ridiculous. Now we're not even philosophers, even though we're practicing philosophy, because we don't really love wisdom, we love Aristotle. And that's different. So we've got to be careful about that. So they revived the ridiculous habit of allowing no further question if he had said so. He, as Cicero tells us, was Pythagoras. I certainly believe that Aristotle was a great man who knew much, but he was human and could well be ignorant of some things, even of a great many things. I should say more if those who are as much friends of truth as they are of sex permits. By God, I am convinced, I have no doubt, that he went astray, as the saying goes, the whole length of the way, not only in what is of little weight, where an error is unimportant and by no means dangerous, but in matters of the greatest consequence, and precisely in those regarding supreme salvation. Of happiness he indeed had a good deal to say in the beginning and at the end of his ethics. However, I will dare to say, and my censors may shout as loud as they please, he knew so absolutely nothing of true happiness that any pious old woman, any faithful fisherman, shepherd, or peasant is, I will not say more subtle, but happier in recognizing it. So again, and here, for those of you who read Chesterton, Chesterton makes the statement that one old man saying one prayer on one bead of the rosary has so much a greater understanding of eternity than all the metaphysicians put together in the world. So it doesn't matter if that man never, if he can't read, if he's never had a lick of education, if he understands faith and he understands his relationship to eternity, he's the happy one. We're not. So that's where Petrarch is coming from. So he may sound in parts like he's favoring the humanist over the Christian, but he in fact sees that there has to be a balance. So the Christian always wins if it's only Christianity. Now, if you can be a Christian and a humanist, that's great for this world. Probably is not going to win you any points in the next world, but it's great for this world because we need to be able to pass those things on. But that's what I want you to get out of this. So in the next paragraph then, and he keeps talking about this same thing, it may perhaps be daring to say so, but it is true, unless I am mistaken. It seems to me that he saw of happiness as much as the night owl does of the sun, namely its lights and rays, and not the sun itself. So obviously this is a play on the cave. Aristotle may have saw something, but he's missing the larger reality. For Aristotle did not establish happiness within its own boundaries and did not found it on solid ground, as a high building ought to be founded, but far away in a foreign country on a trembling site, and consequently did not comprehend two things, or if he did, he ignored them. Those are the two things without which there can be absolutely no happiness, faith and immortality. I already regret saying that he did not comprehend them or ignore them, for I ought to have said only one of the two phrases. Faith and immortality were not yet comprehended. He did not know of them, nor could he know of them or hope for them. The true light had not begun to shine, which lightens every man who comes into this world. He and all the others fancied what they wished, and what, by his very nature, every man wishes, and whose opposite no one can wish. A happiness of which they sing as one song of the absent beloved, and of which they adorned with words. They did not see it. Like people made happy by a dram, a drink, a shot, they rejoiced in an absolute nothing. In fact, they were miserable, and to be roused to their misery by the thunder of approaching death, to see with open eyes what real happiness is like, that with which they had dwelt in their dreams. So he's obviously giving a very Platonic spin on Aristotle, but he's taking us back into the cave and recognizing that Aristotle propelled us backwards, not forwards, in his understanding of things. So again, don't take this as Petrarch hates Aristotle. He doesn't. He loves Aristotle. But he doesn't want us to make Aristotle a god. That's the problem here. And he believes that's exactly what the Christians have done after they've imported him from the Muslims. So let me just throw this one thing out, and Alexander, I'll get you. Dante was very taken with Aristotle, much more than Petrarch is. Even though they overlap, remember Dante's an old man when Petrarch's a young man. So they overlap, but Dante, of course, from Petrarch's view, is the last of the old generation. He's the last of the medieval now. We've started something new. But for those of you, when you read Dante, you'll find that all the philosophers, with just a few exceptions, all sit in a room at the outer edge of hell. So they're not tortured. They're in hell because they didn't know Christ. But they're not tortured. What they do is they sit in a classroom for eternity. And they all have to be, it's everybody from Cicero's in there to Plato and Socrates, and they have to all for eternity listen to Aristotle lecture them. So that's their punishment. So they're not with God, but they're also not eating brains or being consumed by fire or thrown in ice either. They just have to listen to Aristotle. Obviously, Petrarch would not have done that. Right? He would have put Plato probably at the front of that classroom rather than Aristotle. But it's always a kind of a, well, is that a fun game? I don't know. How many of you have read Flannery O'Connor? you guys at least know, great short story writer, but very, very awkward in real life. Just a painful personality, very shy. And she, one time in 1955, she spent the weekend, they were mutual guests at a nice house in Vanderbilt at Nashville. She and Russell Kirk spent the weekend together. Russell Kirk, the founder of post-war conservatism, Flannery O'Connor, probably the best Christian short story writer of the 20th century. And they're both super awkward. They don't know what to say to each other. And they're just sitting there on the couch, kind of staring at one another. And finally, I don't remember which, one of them says, "Why don't we play Dante?" And the other says, "Well, that's, what's that mean?" "Well, let's just put people we don't like in hell and see where they would be." So they start having this rivalry, who would be in hell and who wouldn't. So if you know anybody, if you're familiar with the great educational theorist, John Dewey, they decide that John Dewey should be in the lowest part of hell. Destroyed education. And then they say, well, let's put him there, and his punishment will be that babies have to crawl all over him for eternity, and they have to be diaperless. And the response by Kirk was, no, that's not fair to the babies. So anyway, that was there. So you guys have to forgive me. I have a little bit of that playing Dante. I'm not saying it's charitable or Christian. I'm just saying it's, there's a streak there. So, I'm sorry, Alexander.
So, as he's invoking the cave metaphor, is he putting Plato and Aristotle inside the cave?
Well, he says, the way, as I'm reading it, he's saying that Aristotle is taking us back into the cave after Plato and Socrates brought us out of it. So Aristotle didn't learn enough. He didn't learn enough of the essential things. So that's why he's using the cave analogy, because he's mocking. Aristotle didn't learn from his teacher the way he should have. We generally think of as Aristotle as an advancement on Plato. He's saying no, it was a backwards turn. So it took us the wrong direction. Good. Again, he's not against Aristotle, right? That it's just, he's kind of exaggerating to make his point. All right, any questions then about Petrarch? You guys feel like you have at least a good sense of him and his ideas? Okay, if so, let's look to Pico then. And I would like you, by the way, let me point out one other thing. Sorry, guys, I've got to do this. This is the bottom of, we're still in Petrarch. So the bottom of 530. And on the top of 531, this, and I think this goes to Alexander's question, but after talking about, I do not adore Aristotle, if you see that on the last line before that last paragraph, but I have another whom to adore. He does not promise me empty and frivolous conjectures of deceitful things which are of use for nothing and not supported by any foundation. He promises me the knowledge of himself. When he grants this to me, it will appear superfluous to busy myself with other things that are created by him. One will see that it is easy to grasp them and consequently ridiculous to investigate them. It is he in whom I trust, whom I must adore. It is he whom my judges ought to worship piously. If they did, they would know that philosophers have told many lies. Those, I mean, who are philosophers by name, for true philosophers are wont to say anything what is true. Now, what his point is, and this is where he is not anti-philosophy. In fact, Petrarch's a great philosopher. But what he's saying is, if you're a true philosopher, you're not a Platonist, you're not a Socratic, you're not an Aristotelian, you're a Christian. Because the only real philosopher is Christ. If philosophy is the love of wisdom, Christ is the divine wisdom. Therefore, you love him highest. So that's where Petrarch is saying. So don't get titillated with Aristotle or Cicero or any of these guys. Ultimately, just as Dante said, we don't worship Mary. We appreciate Mary because she moves us towards Christ. Right? That's exactly what he's saying here as well with the philosophers. We don't worship them. We see what's true, and that should move us towards the truth, the love of Christ. Again, you don't have to agree with it, but I want you to understand this Christian humanism of the Middle Ages, late Middle Ages, early Renaissance, is a serious way of thinking, not frivolous by any means. Okay, so let's look at Pico, and very quickly here, and we'll end today looking at Pico. We've just got a few minutes left, but I want this done before you guys get to Machiavelli. Pico dies very young. He's not much older than you guys are when he dies. He is brilliant. There's no question about that. As a young man, he was so smart. He was also so obnoxious that no university really wanted him around. So he goes to college as a very young boy, and he comes up with this list, and I'm not exaggerating. He had something like a list of 900 questions that he thought it was essential he ask all great scholars in Europe. So he would just travel. He's this kind of strange beatnik character who would just move from one university to another, try and find professors in office hours, and then just annoy the you-know-what out of them as he's just asking them one question after another. And this doesn't go over well, as you can imagine. But he goes around Europe until he dies just asking all these questions. But he's also very strange. That's already strange. But he loves magic. He considers himself a magician, and he performs tricks, and he gets into all kinds of Gnostic rites and cults and rituals. And so he's often remembered as Pico the magician or Pico the wizard, because he did believe he was a wizard walking around in Renaissance Europe asking these questions. But what I want you to know for this class is that he firmly believed that there was this great chain of being, which most people did. That's not unusual, I believe in a great chain of being as well. I just don't think it works the way he does. So there's nothing wrong with the great chain of being and the economy of grace. But what he begins to believe, as I mentioned 40 minutes ago, is that he sees the great chain as something to be climbed on. It's not the element of justice where we give each person his due. It's that if we have the right to be depraved by Adam, we also have the right to be, not even sure what the word would be, to become divine. We should have apotheosis through Christ. So if Adam is enough to make us decrepit, Christ is enough to make us God. So this is how he presents it, as kind of a duality. So this is where, John,
sorry.
Please.
Sorry, we weren't God before Adam, though.
Say that again?
We weren't God before.
No, that's right, but we weren't depraved either, right? At least according to Pico.
But
I'm not defending him, I just...
What I'm saying is, Christ can only save us to the level of what Adam made us descend from.
I would agree with you. That's what Pico, though, says, that we can actually go both ways. We can either become diabolic, or we can become angelic and even higher. In fact, we would become higher than God himself. So let me just point out this paragraph as he puts it here. So thank you, John. So look at this is the last paragraph. And by the way, this is a really long writing you have here. All we did, and it's kind of a cheat, but we just gave you the introduction and the conclusion to this whole long thing. But it's because it's what you need to know. And it's everything else is kind of standard humanism from the Renaissance. But notice this is on page 546, line 12, he invokes the chain of being there. But then he explains what he means by that. So you go to the last, and he's put Moses and Timaeus on the same level. So the character of Plato and Moses, he's put on the same level under that. But then look at the last paragraph on page, the whole thing, 547. O supreme generosity of God the Father, O highest and most marvelous felicity of man, to him it is granted to have whatever he chooses, to be whatever he wills. All right, so John, man. Man can choose what he wants. So he can choose to become a couch potato, or he can choose to become a god. This is man. And this is what makes us better than every other creature. This is what we can do with our free will. With our free will, we can either become nothing or we can become gods. That's what our free will does. So we go up and down on the chain of being, determined by what we want to be. Beasts, as soon as they are born, bring with them from their mother's womb all they will ever possess. Generally, that's true. We know, obviously, dolphins, porpoises have language, but at the time he's writing this, it's all they knew. Spiritual beings, either from the beginning or soon thereafter, become what they are to be forever and ever. On man, when he came into life, the Father conferred the seeds of all kinds, unlike other creatures. Animals don't get this choice. Angels don't get this choice. Only man. He conferred the seeds of all kinds and the germs of every way of life. Whatever seeds each man cultivates will grow to maturity and bear in him their own fruit. If they be vegetative, he will be a plant, couch potato. If sensitive, he will become brutish, a bully. If rational, he will grow into a heavenly being, a professor. Just throwing that in. If intellectual, he will be an angel and a son of God. But if unhappy in the lot of no created being, he withdraws into the center of his own unity, his spirit made one with God in the solitary darkness of God, who is set above all things, shall surpass them all. So we can even become greater than God. But this is God's gift to us. God wants us to be whatever we want to be. This is what God does. So you can feel here, when I said a moment ago, Pico was odd, and he played with magic, and thought he was a wizard, and well, now that makes a little bit more sense when you can see he's playing with the occult. He's still got a bit of orthodoxy in him, but he's obviously taking it in really, really weird ways. So I hope as we end today, you understand the difference between a Christian humanist like Petrarch and an idyllic humanist like Pico. He doesn't want us to become evil. He wants us to become good. But he's skipping a lot of steps there for us to become our own gods. Okay, great. So I won't see you guys on Friday. I'm going to be in Grand Rapids, but that's my last trip of the semester. Deidre will be here. So make sure you've read Machiavelli. And then for next week, for Monday, I would like you guys to have read just right at the beginning of the Reformation. So what do we have right at the beginning? Is it Luther, I assume? If you guys would just read Luther for Monday.
Do you happen to have our blue books?
No, I don't have them. I'm sorry. I'm not done yet. So I'm working on them. I'll get into it. No, I'm glad you asked. So thanks, everyone. And I'll see you guys. So you're here Friday, but I'll see you on Monday.
Do you want us to read the Reformation introduction? Or?
Yeah, read. Yes, do read that introduction, but Luther, the writings that we have from Luther. I should have read these more carefully. I should have looked them over before, but
there's
yeah.
There's two of them.
Yeah, read both of those
okay.
From Luther. So Machiavelli for Friday, Luther for Monday. We are really getting close to the end here.
That's